So welcome back to the second chapter of Matthew, which continues and concludes the prologue. So we've seen Jesus is the son of David, and there's a lot in that chapter 1 that made that point. We see he's the son of David, of Abraham. So he's carrying on all the promises from the ancient patriarchs. He's a son of God. We'll have to see what that means, because God and son, it's an analogy. So, and this is highlighted, the son of God, in fact, by portraying Mary as a virgin. This could be a statement of her physical state. If God can say, let there be light, and light was, who are we to put limits on what God can do? I'm not doing that, I hope, and you're not either. So the possibilities are infinite, and the mystery of God, we don't want to be too tight about it. But it does require a miraculous divine intervention. And I at least find it hard to find any reason for it. Jesus can be the Son of God from a normal marriage, of course. And the New Testament, except for the prologue here and in Luke, never mentions the fact of Mary being a virgin. But that doesn't make it not possible, of course. Could Matthew, and this is what I'm suggesting to you as a thought, could he be capturing the intimacy of Mary's mystical communion with God? Giving her first love to God. And one would hope that that would be the case with every conception from the father and the mother. Either way, Matthew's interest, which shows right through the rest of the Gospel and the whole New Testament, is to keep us focused on Jesus. If we want to know who Jesus is, and we want to know where his words come from and where his actions come from, then Matthew is saying, look at God. See God revealed in him. See him as expressing in a human way who God really is. That's certainly what's in the prologue and throughout the Gospel. Now we come to chapter 2. There's no birth narrative. There is one in Luke, a beautiful one which we're familiar with from Christmas, but there's no one, not in Matthew. He just mentioned it. When Jesus was born in Bethlehem, but he doesn't describe it, of Judea in the days of King Herod, behold, magi, wise men, magi from the east came to Jerusalem. All wisdom comes from the east in the stories of the Greeks and the Romans and the people in this part of the world, because the east is where the sun rises. The sun brings light. The wisdom comes from the east with the dawning of the morning sun. Magi came from the east to Jerusalem, and they said, where is the king of the Jews who was born? We have seen his star at its rising, and we've come to pay homage to him. Let's stay with that scene a little bit longer. In the book of Numbers, we read, a star will come out of Jacob, a scepter shall arise out of Israel. In Hellenistic, that's Greek in the Eastern world, not Greek in Greece, in the Hellenistic sources, there are reports of a comet at the birth of Mithridates, He was the king of Pontus, just under the Black Sea in Armenia, and one of the great, he's called Mithridates the Great. He was an enemy of the Roman Empire in the first century. So at the birth of Mithridates, according to the legends, a star was seen. And in Nero, according to Suetonius, a star appeared. There are also reports of comets or other light phenomena at the birth of the gods. On coins of Alexander the Great and of the Diadochi, that is Alexander's rival generals, of Caesar himself, of Augustus, but also of Alexander Janneus, who's Hebrew, and Herod, a star appears as a symbol of the king. So it's a very common, and you can understand it, of course, so can I, image for something marvellous that's going to happen, and the heavens are revealing it with a of a star. Furthermore, the idea is widespread in this world that every person has a star. Important and wealthy people have a bright star, others a dim one. It comes into existence at birth, your star in the heavens, and astrology, of course, follows this through to what seem to me fairly ridiculous goals, but the idea is pretty common. Comes into existence at birth and extinguished at death. This idea is the basis of popular astrology in that time. So let's get back to the text. So a star appeared. We're going to expect a heavenly significant event that will show how important this birth is. When King Herod heard that, he became dismayed and all Jerusalem with him. And he gathered all the chief priests and scribes. First time they've been mentioned, and they're going to feature all the way through the Gospels. Ultimately, it's the chief priests and scribes who are responsible for the crucifixion of Jesus. So all the chief priests and scribes of the people and inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. And they said, and they go back through their prophetic literature, in Bethlehem, in Judea. For thus it's written through the prophet, you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, you are by no means least among the princes of Judah. For out of you will come a leader who will shepherd my people Israel. That's from the prophet Micah, a contemporary of Isaiah in the 700s BC. Matthew is preparing the reader for Jesus' death at the hands of these chief priests and scribes. Herod, the text goes on, summoned the Magi. Notice they're not called kings. That's come as a later addition to the story. And there's no indication there's three of them. That's a later stories take on a life of their own, of course. But here in the text itself, they're simply called Magi, wise, Gentile people. Herod summoned the Magi secretly and inquired from them when exactly the star appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, look, go, question carefully about the child, and when you found him, report to me so that I too can come and pay homage to him. A forked tongue, that's not Herod's intention at all, of course. After they'd heard that from the king, they went away, and behold, the star that had been seen at its rising went before them till it came and stopped over the place where the child was. And when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly. When they came to the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and paid homage. And they opened their treasure chests and brought out gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And because they received divine instructions in a dream not to return to Herod, they returned to their country a different way. In Psalm 72, and the author is drawing on Psalm, and it's a midrash, it's a story, applying the imagery of the psalm to this wonderful birth. Psalm 72 reads, "May the kings of Tarshish and of the isles render him tribute. May the kings of Sheba and Saba." Sheba is present Yemen at the bottom of the Arabian Gulf, and Saba is on the opposite side of the Red Sea. "May all kings bow down before him and all nations give him service." The author is drawing also on Isaiah chapter 60, which reads, "Arise, shine, for your light has come. The glory of the Lord has risen upon you. Darkness shall cover the earth, and thick darkness the peoples. But the Lord," that's Yahweh, "will arise upon you. His glory will appear over you. Nations shall come to your light, kings to the brightness of your dawn. Then you shall see and be radiant. Your heart shall thrill and rejoice, because the abundance of the sea shall be brought to you. The wealth of the nation shall come to you. A multitude of camels shall cover you, and young camels of Midian and Ephah. All those from Sheba shall come. They shall bring gold and frankincense and shall proclaim the praise of the Lord." You can see where Matthew got his imagery from for this dramatic introduction to Jesus. Gold and frankincense. The author, Lewis, writes, "A new Christological perspective. Worship is directed to the Son of God. That is seen especially in the interpretation of the gifts. Since Irenaeus," so that's going back to the second century, "and Origen, the myrrh has been understood as a reference to Jesus' death. Jesus receives gold as a king and frankincense as divine, as God, and myrrh as a human being. Sometimes the frankincense is also related to Jesus' dignity as a high priest. These interpretations of the gifts illustrate how the ancient church read individual passages of the Bible in the light of the church's faith. The allegorical interpretation is of the greatest fundamental hermeneutical significance." We're dealing with midrash, stories, seen as stories, recognized as stories, but as with all important stories, we're meant to try to understand what's the meaning behind the story. What's he trying to convey most of all? And being a story, it'll have a whole lot of light shone on many matters. It's about the mission to the Gentiles coming from the East. God's protection of the early church from its enemies. The Emperor Justinian died in 565 when, of course, Rome had been abandoned by the Emperor and he'd gone to the new city of Constantinople after Constantine. Well, in San Apollinare Nuovo in North Italy, in Ravenna, you've got the names of Balthazar, Melchior and Caspar first appear in the 6th century. They want to name the stories, namely characters in the story. Just for your interest, frankincense is the resin of the frankincense trees that grow in Southeast Arabia, in India and in Somalia. So they were rich, expensive trade coming with camels from the East to Greece and to Rome and so on. Myrrh is the resin of the myrrh trees that grow in Arabia and Ethiopia. Sheba and Seba. And they were used primarily in the cult, but also for magical practices, at wedding ceremonies, for cosmetic purposes, and as seasoning or medication. Both frankincense and myrrh were regarded as very expensive imported luxury items. Well, here they are coming from the East to the king. Matthew 2:13. After the wise men had left, the angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. And the angel said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, flee to Egypt. Remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." So Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night and went to Egypt. Joseph doesn't say anything in any of the Gospels. He's presented here, of course, as an amazingly just man. All he wanted was to do the will of God, and that's all he ever did. The only word he ever spoke is Jesus. Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night, and went to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. And this is the prophet Hosea. "Out of Egypt I've called my son." The origin of that is, of course, the son is Israel, God's firstborn, as they saw it, God's chosen people. He was their national, cultic God. Others had their gods too. The Babylonians had their gods, the Greeks had gods, the Romans had gods. Everybody had a god. They're all over the place. But their God was this mysterious, wonderful, liberating presence that took them out of slavery and led them through the desert to the promised land. Well, God called Israel out of Egypt. And now he's calling, in the story, did Jesus actually ever go physically to Egypt? Well, I don't know. And we're not told he was. The story has him doing it, of course, because it's making a very important point about Jesus. That Jesus is the new Moses. That's what we're getting prepared for. The new Moses who took the people out of Egypt. Jesus is going to take us out of Egypt, inverted commas, out of sin, out of being lost, out of stupidity, out of missing the mark, out of sin, etc. Here, the book of Exodus says, Pharaoh sought to kill Moses. You know that. Moses fled from Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian. Jesus flees from Bethlehem, from Judea, when Herod's alive, and goes to Egypt. When Herod saw that he'd been tricked by the wise men, he was infuriated, and he sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he'd learnt from the wise men. Then was fulfilled, Matthew, you're going to see, loves to find texts in the scripture that are fulfilled by Jesus. Fulfilled doesn't mean the people in the past foresaw Jesus. That's hopeless. They're writing about their situation, but in the light of their experience of Jesus, the gospel writers look back and say, look what we said in the book of Exodus or Numbers or wherever. Look what the prophets said. Can't you see that Jesus fulfills that in an astonishingly unexpected but totally beautiful way? Christianity is the way to be a Jew, is what he's saying to them. This thus was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation. Rachel was weeping for her children and refused to be consoled because they are no more. Rachel was Jacob's favourite wife and the mother of Joseph and Benjamin, just north of Judea, of Judah, which is the southern tribe, and then to the north are the 10 other tribes. I won't go into that because it's too complicated. But it's sandwiched in between the northern Israel and Judah is a tiny tribal area of Joseph, of Benjamin. And I'll stop telling it here. Those to be transported into exile to Babylon were collected in Ramah, in the tribal region of Benjamin. They were taken from Jerusalem, collected in this tribal area, hence the reference to Benjamin's mother Rachel. So it's picking up the awful pain of the exile and the mother, Jacob is the father, right, and Rachel is the mother, weeping for her children who are being banished and carted into exile, Jerusalem having been destroyed. So that imagery is picked up in this painful occurrence in Bethlehem. Chapter verse 19, when Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt. Get up, take the child and his mother. Go to the land of Israel, for those who are seeking the child's life are dead. Herod, often called Herod the Great, died, it appears, in 4 BC. Well, the early scholars didn't have our advantages, and the timing of Jesus' birth on a world scale missed out by 4 or 4.5 years. So Jesus was actually born, in fact, during the life of Herod the Great. So 4 and a bit years before AD. Don't think that'll worry anybody, but that seems to be it. Get up, take the child and his mother, go to the land of Israel, for those who were seeking the child's life are dead. Matthew is drawing, so obvious, on the book of Exodus, chapter 4, verse 19 and 20, which reads, "The Lord said to Moses, go back to Egypt," well, here it's go back to Judah, "go back to Egypt, those who are seeking your life are dead." Matthew's simply quoting that. So Moses took his wife and his sons, put them on a donkey, and went back to the land of Egypt. Joseph is here doing the same for Mary and Jesus. Verse 22. After being warned in a dream, Joseph went away to the district of Galilee. There he made his home in a town called Nazareth. Nazareth isn't mentioned in any of the ancient scrolls when they talk about the towns in different places. It never mentions Nazareth. It's quite likely that Joseph went there, which it tells he does. Jesus may have been born there too. It's quite possible, in fact. But Joseph is there as a carpenter because Herod Antipas, that's the Herod, the son of Herod the Great, one of them, and he was building his capital city, Zephyrus, the hill of the bird. It's a high hill, only down the valley, over the top, and there it is from Nazareth. Joseph went there probably with his brothers to find work and found work as a carpenter. Jesus no doubt joined him when he was old enough to help as a builder, really, more than a carpenter, but anyhow, including carpentry, and they went there. So it could be that Nazareth was actually begun by the Joseph family. It's not unlikely. Just a group of them. It's a little town. And Mary's there, and the wives of Joseph's brothers are there too, with their kids, whom we hear about in the Gospel. He made his home in a town called Nazareth, so that what had been spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled. Another desire of Matthew to go back to the ancient texts. There's a problem here. He quotes this, "He will be called a Nazarene." Actually, that doesn't appear in any of the ancient texts. That's not a problem, but he's imagining it, or he's drawing on other texts like this one. Because the word Nazareth, it might come from the Hebrew word the singer. It's quite possible. And maybe it's a reference to Jesus. Maybe it got its name later because of the famous Jesus, who was the singer, the one who had these beautiful, which the prophets often did, one-liners or two-liners of wisdom. And perhaps Jesus was the singer. And so the name of the town is named after him. It's likely. Or it might come from other texts where a similar word in Hebrew is used, is one of them. "On that day," says Isaiah, "the branch of the Lord shall be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the Lord shall be the pride and glory of survivors of Israel. Whoever is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem," and here's our text, "will be called holy." Matthew, he will be called, and he doesn't say holy, he says a Nazarene. Well, the Nazarenes were, it was a vow people could take. They cut their hair and John the Baptist took it. And Paul was to take it once when he was in Achaia. So it could be a kind of a religious action to ritualize something. So it's all kind of a bit mixed up. In the book of Numbers, you hear about the Nazarite vow. So, in chapter 2, which we've concluded now, Matthew focuses on Jesus' mission. He was born in the city of David. Whether historically or not, I don't know. But he's born of the family of David. That's the point. The house of Bethlehem. He's to be king of the Jews. He's to enlighten the Gentile world as well. And by the time Matthew is writing his gospel, Christianity was an amazing phenomenon. It was spreading so quickly in that first, second, third century, and to no social advantage. Persecutions made sure of that. And this Christian group was often oppressed because the crowd all worshipped these many gods. And if there was a bad season, well, that means they hadn't prayed properly to the goddess of the harvest. Well, here were the Christians not joining in any of this. They worshipped God, and they didn't worship any of the statues or the. So, of course, they were to be blamed, and there were mobs would attack them. It wasn't state organized, it was just mob violence against this group that refused to assuage the gods and make sure everything was going well for us. Well, that's the situation. But Christianity kept spreading. Why? It's kind of obvious, and the literature bears this out, because it actually was about love. People felt loved. There wasn't this division. There was this sense of belonging. There was this extraordinary understanding of who God really is, and it went across all cultures and etc. The Gentile world was attracted to this sensible, amazing, mystical, beautiful communion of people. He's to fulfill the destiny for which Israel came out of Egypt on the journey to the promised land. Jesus is going to show us all through the gospel how to journey to the promised land. The offering of myrrh and the weeping of Rachel prepare us for suffering. Matthew writes to capture hearts and minds with the wonder of Jesus' person, whose mission is to fulfill the kingdom of God, not the reign of Zeus or any of these other gods and goddesses who behaved like bad human beings often, and it was about violence and power, a lot of it. There would have been beautiful elements in it, no doubt, but on the whole, it was might is right, certainly in the Roman world. Here was a whole new way of looking at God as love that transcended all cultures. I'll conclude with a hymn, Incarnate.
Oh, I give my life to love you evermore. I long just to love you, O God, to serve and adore you, O God. I long just to love you, O God, my Jesus. To serve and adore.